This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. A professor from UC Blue Ash took an appeal in a murder trial all the way to the Ohio Supreme Court, argued before the justices, and recently learned she's won that case. Wendy Calloway is a practicing attorney and a professor in the Behavioral Science Department at UC Blue Ash, where she teaches criminal justice, criminology, and corrections courses. The Ohio Supreme Court decision she won will reshape the way future criminal trials across the state are handled. Wendy Calloway joins us to talk about the case, the appeals process, and how she's using this as a teaching experience for her students. Wendy, thanks for being here today. Good to see you.
It's good to see you as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me about the case this revolved around, Wendy.
Okay, the case is a couple years old, and I actually wasn't the attorney that represented the defendant at the trial level. I got involved in the first appeal, but the allegation was that there was a murder in Cincinnati that revolved around a drug transaction. The state alleged that my client went to meet the decedent and to sell him drugs, and the state also thought that there was my client planned to rob the decedent. And so they had some evidence. There's some question about the quality of that evidence. A lot of what they presented at trial relied on the testimony of jailhouse informants who were testifying in exchange for case consideration or promises of leniency on their own criminal trials if they came forward and testified against the defendant in this case. So their evidence was a little shaky at best, but they presented the evidence that my client went to this location to sell drugs to the decedent. The state alleged that he intended to rob the decedent and that in the course of that transaction, he shot and killed the decedent.
So this was a pretty serious trial then. I mean, what could the punishment have been if the conviction had stood?
Yeah, it was. It's the most serious charge that you can be charged with. He was charged with aggravated murder, which did not have a death penalty specification on it. But so the worst sentence that he could have received was life without the possibility of parole, which is what he did get.
Now, you say you came on during the appeals process. How exactly did you get involved?
The trial attorney that was representing Mr. Harris at the trial level is a colleague of mine, and he asked the court to appoint me to represent Mr. Harris in the appeal. I have gained a reputation over the last few years. I've been practicing for 17 years, but as being an expert in appellate law. So it's different than being a trial attorney, and I do try cases, but I'm willing to do the research and do the writing that is involved with doing appeals. And so a lot of my colleagues will ask me to take on cases if they lose them at trial or ask the court to appoint me to represent indigent defendants that can't afford to hire an attorney. And so the state is obligated to provide them with a defense both at the trial and at the appellate level. And so he asked the court to appoint me.
Now, did this case go through the Court of Appeals that's the intermediary step in Ohio?
Yes, the First District Court of Appeals is here in Hamilton County and has jurisdiction over all the appeals from the Hamilton County Court.
And did they hear this first before it got to the Supreme Court?
Correct. We took the case after he was convicted at the trial level. We appealed to the First District, which is what we're required to do. And we won at that level. The appellate court reviewed the cases. I wrote a brief, did some research on it. The state also wrote a brief and did some research. Then we had an argument in front of the First District. And they agreed in part and disagreed in part with the argument that I made. But ultimately, they agreed that the trial wasn't fair and that Mr. Harris should get a new trial.
Okay, and this ended up at the Supreme Court because
the state didn't like that, as you can imagine, and so they appealed to the Ohio Supreme Court. The Ohio Supreme Court is a court of limited jurisdiction, which means they don't have to take all the appeals that are filed there. The First District does have to hear every appeal that's filed, but the Supreme Court, they have jurisdiction over what they want to hear, and it's really kind of hard to get them to take a case. They only take a small percentage of cases that they feel would have general applicability throughout criminal law or civil law, whatever the case may be, to people in the state. And so when the state filed this appeal, they accepted it and heard it.
Now, your client, Joseph Harris, you argued that allowing the testimony of a court-appointed psychologist after Harris abandoned his insanity plea violated his constitutional rights. How so? What rights were specifically violated in that?
So there's two things that were really at play here. The first one is the concept that in criminal law in the United States, we want defendants to be convicted on the actual facts of the particular case. We do not want defendants to be convicted because they are bad people or because people don't like them or because they have a reputation for not being a nice person. And so the first, I think, most important thing that was involved in this case was that they called this court-appointed psychiatrist who had some information about Mr. Harris because he was forced to submit to a psychiatric evaluation to see if he was competent to stand trial. So the psychiatrist had some information about him and formed some opinions, and she offered testimony at trial basically that he was a bad person, that he was prone to violence, that he was a dangerous person. And the court felt, and I felt, and the court agreed with me, that that is not the kind of evidence that we want to base criminal convictions on. Criminal convictions should only be based on whether or not the defendant committed the act, not on whether he's a good or a bad person or whether someone has bad opinions of him. The second issue that was at play here was the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. Everybody kind of knows about that. You have the right to remain silent. But there's a lot of different ways in which that comes to fruition in a case. And in this particular case, he was forced to submit to this evaluation to see if he was competent to stand trial, because we don't put people on trial that are incompetent. And because he was forced to submit to that evaluation, the state was able to gain information about him based on his statements. And we don't force defendants to be witnesses against themselves in a trial. And in this case, because he was forced to submit to that evaluation, the state had his statements that they then used against him. So there were two big constitutional issues involved in this case.
Now, what happened to Harris during his original trial where the psychologist's testimony was allowed in, has that been a common practice by prosecutors?
I'm going to say no, it is not. I've never seen someone try to do that before. It was a pretty aggressive and bold move by the state, honestly. There were a few other instances once I started doing some research where I saw that prosecutors had attempted to do things like this, and it was not well received by the courts. But it was such a dangerous thing in terms of defendants having fair trials, and that's why I think the court took it. Even though it's not a common practice, they wanted to make sure that they stated in unequivocal terms that you may not call a psychiatrist just to opine generally about the character of a defendant.
Now, the fact that the Supreme Court decision was unanimous must mean that you mounted a pretty strong argument. What was the time frame like, and how long did it take them to reach a decision?
I went in the spring, and the decision, they took a year to come out with a decision. So the decision was just issued in January of 2015. And so normally there's no set time frame for the way that they make decisions, but it's usually within a couple months, 3 to 6 months. This took a year's time for them to come back with a decision.
Wow, that must have been pretty nerve-wracking.
It was hard on me because I didn't know I have any answers, but it was really difficult for my client who was kept waiting. He was facing a life sentence without the possibility of parole. I kept telling him, like, you have a good case. I think we're going to win this case. But I wasn't really producing on that because the Supreme Court was taking its time. It's interesting, during the oral argument, the bench was very aggressive. And even though I felt very confident about my case when I went in to do the argument, after some of the justices had questions for me at the hearing, I was a little shaken and thinking, like, at least it's going to be split. If I win, it's going to be split, because there were some of them that were pretty aggressive against me. So when it came out unanimous, I was really surprised.
So which is easier, being interviewed by a guy on public radio or arguing before the Ohio Supreme Court?
Well, your questions are very incisive, but I have to say facing the justices was a little tougher. That was my first time in the Supreme Court, and it's an imposing place.
So now this is precedent. All future trials have to follow this, right?
That is correct, yes.
Could this decision have an impact on previous cases where something similar could have happened?
That's a good question. It's complicated. The answer is possibly. If there's a case that's pending right now where this issue had come up, then there is a chance that a defendant may be entitled to relief based on this decision. If a case is closed, it depends on how long it's been from the time of the conviction until the time that the defendant tries to reopen his case, as to whether or not he may be able to use this to get relief. I think if someone's in that position, they would be wise to seek legal advice on that issue. Because it just depends on the procedural posture of the case.
You say you're gaining a reputation as an expert in the appeals process. So what makes the whole appeals process so interesting to you?
I think it's because I really, you know, as corny as it sounds, I love the law and I love the power that ideas have to make a change in people's lives. And that's really what we are dealing with when we talk about the law and the legal world, are just ideas. You know, the whole concept of their criminal justice system was based on an idea. And all of those ideas now are being refined and distilled and constantly going before the court for further clarification. The Constitution is such a fascinating document because it was broad enough to sort of cover everything for hundreds of years. But we need the courts to step in and to kind of help us when there's a conflict, tell us what certain things mean. And to be a part of shaping that is such an honor. And so when you go in front of a court of appeals, you're making law that affects not only your client, but for people who are confronted with those issues for years in the future.
How do you respond to someone who says that attorneys are just trying to get their clients off on technicalities?
You know, as a criminal defense attorney, you hear things like that a lot. And that's part of the reason why I'm so happy to be here today, is that part of what I want to do in my career and in my practice is to educate people about how important it is that the law is followed. There's an adage that we talk about in law school that it's better for 100 guilty people to go free than for one innocent person to be convicted. And so the idea is that when we follow the law for everyone, that the law then protects you, it protects me, it protects the law-abiding citizens, it protects everyone, and that by following the law, we protect the innocent. And so even if it seems that somebody who may have been guilty of something gets to walk out the courthouse doors, what that does when we follow the law, when we have fidelity to the law, is protects the innocent. Because if we start ignoring cases where we think, well, that person's really guilty, so the law doesn't matter, then the society devolves into anarchy and no one is protected.
And that's what makes the appeals process and our system of justice so important.
Yeah, I think that the idea is that we have a loyalty to following the law. And once we have an appreciation that that matters, it matters for you, it matters for me, it matters for the person walking down the street, that we need good lawyers to get involved in advocating that not just you and I follow the law, not just my clients have to follow the law, but the police have to follow the law, the prosecutors have to follow the law, the judges have to follow the law. Everybody agrees that this is the standard that's going to apply, and we all follow it.
How have your students reacted to all of this?
You know, I think they're pretty fascinated by it. I have been getting a lot of good feedback in class. They think I'm a rock star now. This case came out last spring, so the classes that I was teaching then, they got to watch the oral argument when I was in Columbus. And so my students now that are hearing about the case, they want to watch it. So it's archived on the Supreme Court's website. I might play it for them at some point, but they're very interested in it, and they've been really enthusiastic about it.
So you're able to use this as a teaching experience for your students.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way that the Supreme Court has set up access to information on their website is amazing. It allows the public to see what goes on behind what has traditionally been closed doors. Even though the courtrooms are all open to the public, it's difficult for people who have jobs to get to the courthouse to see what's happening. And so with these live feeds that they've set up now, not only can my students see it and have an educational opportunity to observe what happens in court, but the clients themselves, if they are incarcerated or even if they're out, if they have access to a computer, they can watch these arguments that unfold in front of the Supreme Court.
So, sounds like the transparency in Ohio's court system is getting better. How important is that?
It's improved a great deal, because I think in order for people, we want people to follow the law. We want people to have faith in the law. We want people to have faith in the judges and elected officials. If they don't know what's happening, it's difficult for them to do that. And so this is a way for them to see what happens, and also for all of us that work in that system to be held accountable to our respective roles.
Wendy, any plans to argue before the Ohio Supreme Court in the future?
You never know. I would certainly welcome the opportunity to do that. I feel very good about what I was able to accomplish up there. It was an incredible experience for me. You know, I was talking about what it's been able to do for my students and what they can learn from it. But it was a great experience for me as well. And should I have the opportunity to go back and try to advocate on behalf of one of my clients, I would welcome it.
Wendy, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Attorney Wendy Calloway is a professor at UC Blue Ash. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.